Welcome, everyone, to episode number 107 of Underserved. Joining me today is Jason Judge, Vice President of Data at Okta. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew. It is awesome to be here and just to be able to be a part of a podcast that is telling the hidden side of our world. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, let's delve into the hidden side of yours. So way back when, Southern California, grew up tinkering a bit. What was that like?
I like to see how things work. As a kid, I was an only child for the first 17 years of my life. So I had a lot of time to tinker, whether that was with Legos or taking apart the family electronics, setting VCRs and the like. I had the opportunity to be around a lot of computer technology where we lived growing up, where I had exposure to, you know, a computer lab in the first grade. For instance, it opened my eyes to a whole nother world of tinkering where it wasn't just the physical world that I could play with, but there was software that you could write and interact with. And it just really captured my interest.
Now, you ended up moving to Washington and ended up in Redmond right around the time that Win 95 is coming out. This is a watershed moment for Microsoft. What happens next?
It was. I mean, the world's introduction to Chips Challenge and Ski Free. How could we forget that time in our life? It was sort of a random place to move to. My family wasn't necessarily involved in technology, but one thing or another brought us to Redmond. And going to Redmond High School, we had, again, another computer lab. Again, very fortunate that Mrs. Westrup ran. She ran all of our business classes at Redmond. And we had these shiny new computers, courtesy of Microsoft. And Mrs. Westrup made sure that we were given the opportunity to do our own thing in those classes. She really leaned into people's strengths, whether it was business communications or business law. She was making sure that the computer became a central part to what we were doing and how we were learning. She easily could have glossed over that fact. She could have easily just taught the old curriculum. She saw that the future was coming, and I learned a ton from her.
So you go to state school, University of Washington. Do you end up like kind of carrying this forward, or did you know what you wanted to do when you got there?
I think I changed majors 6 times while I was at UW. I wasn't what you would call the best student. I was in an econ class once that was on the front page of the student newspaper. There was a picture of the classroom above the fold, right there, dead center. And I was not in that picture because I chose to oversleep that day and miss the class. And so I got endless grief from my friends that did attend the class and were on the front page of the newspaper.
Did the caption say, "Not pictured, Jason Judge"?
It very well could have, yeah. But at a big school like that, you know, 30,000 students, one of the great things is you have the opportunity to try lots of different things. So I tried a communications major, speech communications major. Architecture was what I went there to do originally. And I think all the different majors that I considered and bounced through, they all ended up having an element of truly arts and sciences. And when I landed in economics, it wasn't like a grand vision. It was, hey, here's an opportunity to have a major that kind of speaks to those different sides of my brain. You could be in a class that is combining math and social psychology, for instance, to try and explain the world around you. I had no idea at the time. It was probably 15, 20 years after graduating that I really realized that I was kind of meant to do this data thing from way back when.
Now, while you're there, you also got involved with the Experimental College. What was that?
The Experimental College was started during the hippie heyday in the late 60s, and it was a way to have a student-run organization that was entirely taught by community members. So if you want to take salsa lessons or learn how to make salsa, or if you want to learn a language, basically anything that somebody in the community felt that they had a marketable skill, they would come and teach that class, and it was completely student-run. So we got to learn all about how to do facilities management and booking all of the rooms. We got to make the catalog from scratch. We had print design department. My job there was as the second webmaster in the college's history. The guy before me, Don Isaac, he recruited me out of the Eddie Bauer stock room where we had both worked previously. He had put the website online. I then took it to the next level with posting our catalog online for the first time, which, let me tell you, in the late 90s, not a lot of great options for dynamic websites and integrated database management. That puppy was 100% hand-coded in Notepad. One by one HTML files uploaded to the server.
Ooh, not even some CGI and Perl?
I think I got a little fancy with some JavaScript back then. And I remember somebody making fun of me saying, JavaScript? No one's ever going to use JavaScript.
So you're graduating in 2000. Like, dot-com era is in full swing. What's your job search like?
All these delusions of grandeur of everybody's becoming millionaires out there. And so I thought, yeah, let's stay in this tech thing. Like any person in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was straight to the newspaper. And it was opening it up and circling things in a red pen and basically calling, you know, still using the telephone. I had a variety of interviews. I had one interview that was in the loading dock of a restaurant supply warehouse. I had another interview that was in a founder's living room, where they had printed out dozens, if not hundreds, of home pages of various internet properties, and they had covered their entire living room floor. And basically it was, this is our competition and this is what we're going to do. Unfortunately, the business plan was just, let's compete with Yahoo, which wasn't that great of an idea back then. It was very offline. It was very analog.
Didn't you have an early interview with Amazon?
I did. Turns out that could have been a decent place to get a job. I did not do well on that interview. Basically froze when it came to some really basic questions. But it's probably one of the greatest jobs I didn't get, because it was for a webmaster job. And I don't think that would have been my calling or my passion to be just posting books on a website.
So you did notice when someone has this mind map on their floor that GoToNet recognized them. What happened next?
I did. GoToNet owned a number of web properties, one of which was my favorite search engine at the time, Metacrawler. Metasearch was, they would search the search engine so you don't have to. So you'd run one query and it would search all the big names, Lycos, Hotbot, Alta Vista, and bring the results back into one pane. And at the time, it was revolutionary. It started out at the University of Washington and was really brilliant tech. So I saw an opportunity to work there. And it was at a time when companies couldn't hire fast enough. And I literally went in there for one interview, and throughout the course of my day was then offered three different jobs by three different hiring managers that all were just asked in at a moment's notice. Hey, we got this guy in here. We think he's pretty good. You should talk to him about your job.
He has a pulse. He seems pretty smart.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing they didn't like was this guy, Elliot, was interviewing me, and he asked me to literally take my tie off, or he was going to cut it off. I didn't realize that times were changing. This was no longer Michael J. Fox and The Secret of My Success, where you need the suspenders to make it to the corner office. It was, you know, lots of cargo shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah, the dot-com hardo thing where, you know, the anti-suits was strong back then.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, made for some questionable fashion choices for all of us at one point or another.
Amen. So the Friday before your Monday start date, what do you find out?
I got a phone call from my mother saying, did you see the newspaper? And the company that I had accepted a job with, GoToNet, was being acquired by Infospace. And I didn't know if I still had a job waiting for me on Monday. And so I tried calling, I tried emailing, didn't get through to anybody. So I said, well, I'll show up anyway. Thankfully, I showed up on Monday and the job was still safe. I was lucky enough to get my foot in the door.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
So what do you end up learning while you're there for new technology?
My initial job was really working more with customers. And so we had these advertisers that needed to get their ads online and see the performance. I literally got an email from a customer one time that asked, if it wasn't too much trouble, would it be possible to make it so that somebody could click on their advertisement and go to her company's website? She thought she was just paying for eyeballs in display advertising, like a billboard on the side of the road. So of course we were really snarky, and we, five of us, combined to write an email back saying, gosh, we may have to stay late this weekend, but we will get that done for you.
We're gonna have to charge double.
Mm-hmm. So I had customers on that end of the spectrum, but I had a lot of really intelligent customers as well that were starting to see the performance value of internet measurement. They were starting to look at their own IIS logs and grep those out and try to see their own performance and refer management and things like that. And so I was quickly getting lapped by their knowledge. And I thankfully became friends with the DBAs at our company, who were cousins, Steve and Eugene. And they said, listen, if you learn SQL, we can give you database access and you can get all the data you want about your customer's performance. And so friend Scott Finholm helped me out. He taught me SQL on the weekends and after work. And I was able to go back and prove to Steve and Eugene, yep, I'm not going to bring the database down. Mind you, they gave me access to prod, which probably wouldn't happen today. So I understand why they were worried about no locks and runaway queries. So that was my first foray into the world of data. From the very beginning, I was hooked on the way I could answer questions. Everybody loves to be helpful, right? And I could actually be helpful for my customers. Having the ability to go get those answers and then find new insights. I can remember doing an analysis for a customer of mine, a cable TV provider in the Northeast, and high concentration of customers in New York City. They were having a lot of trouble figuring out the traffic and why their ads were performing or not performing at certain points in the year. And we went through lots of different iterations of analysis. We eventually overlaid weather data on top of their website performance and activities. And it was almost a direct correlation between rainy days and sunny days, highs and lows, of when it's gross out in New York City, people were more likely to be home and utilizing the service. When it was nice out, their traffic would go down. But we had these two outliers that were just unexplainable by the weather data. And I thought, you know what? What if we look at sports? And wouldn't you know it, it was the Yankees opening day, and I believe it was the playoffs, were these two really unexplainable outliers where nobody was paying attention to clicking on ads. They were watching the Yankees.
Well, nowadays, they're all there on their phones looking at ads while they're watching the Yankees.
That's actually, yeah, that's pretty funny. If you look at Yankees attendance in the last few weeks, nobody's been at the games watching the Yankees.
Yeah, the Jets are about to have a problem too. So is it the new skills you got or the new network or both that lead you to Marchex?
It was mostly the network. I ended up working for a number of companies that had a lot of the same founders over the years, companies changing their names and merging back in with itself. And so a lot of the founders at Marchex were the GoToNet founders as well. It was an entrepreneurial group, a lot of energy. We were in some interesting businesses that don't always pan out, but you're at least learning something new every day. And there's a lot of activity and a lot of movement. And you get in the trenches with people, right? It's like being on a team with a lot of these folks and can really count on them to do their part, and they're counting on you.
And while you're here, you start moonlighting a bit?
A little bit, maybe a little more than I let on to the team there. But that's the challenge when you work with an entrepreneurial group, right? You get that itch yourself. And I had talked to a few colleagues and friends from other businesses, and we were all seeing the same opportunities with data. You know, this is the 2004, 2005 timeframe when the ability to actually track and store data is becoming easier. ERP systems are coming down market. You know, Microsoft really led the charge there with the various acquisitions they did in that space. And so you have companies that have a bunch of data they're putting in, they don't know how to get it out, and they don't know what to do with it. And so it was just a sense of good timing in terms of we were able to build up a pretty decent book of business out of the gate and prove out that, yeah, we can extract value from this data for people. And that was our whole sales pitch is, look, you're already paying Microsoft for the SQL Server license. You're already getting things like reporting services. You're already getting some of these tools for free. We're not going to charge you for software. We're just going to help you unlock that value. Looking back, I had no idea how hard professional services actually was. We thought we would do that for a little while just to be able to build the product on the customer's dime. And then we'd have this reusable set of components that, you know, we'd be printing money. Didn't quite turn out like that because I guess every customer is a little different and we were always customizing something. So there was never that rinse and repeat point that we got to. But I look at that time period as it was really my MBA.
And what did you learn during your on-the-job MBA?
I learned things like making payroll is really hard and stressful when you start having your first employees that you hired that aren't founders, that is a whole new level of stress. I learned things like leasing office space with one company and merging your company with one of their competitors is not the smartest business decision because then you're forced to do things like pack up your entire office in 2 hours and get out of there before they come back. Unconventional lessons to be sure, but lessons nonetheless.
Is this where you met Dan Fine?
It is. Yeah. Dan's company, Fine Solutions, is the company that we merged with. And Dan was kind of a larger than life presence in the Pacific Northwest ERP community, you know, really exclusive club there. We were always hearing Dan's name on every job we were doing. And when I finally met him, he was one of the most caring, gregarious, honest people that I had ever come across in business. And he really showed me that there's more than just making a buck. We went on a sales call one time after we had merged the companies, and the whole angle was I was bringing the data side, he was bringing the ERP side, and it was like chocolate and peanut butter. Well, we show up at this client site, and his dog jumps out of the car, and he's got his dog Clark with him. And I was looking at him like, you're bringing your dog to a client pitch. And I thought he had just lost it. We go in there. Everybody loved that dog. It defused a really tense customer. They were now all of a sudden loving and warm. I learned at that point, you do not question Dan Fine. He knows what right is.
I'm going to have to bring my dog to my next sales pitch.
Yeah, give it a shot, you know?
It sounds like Dan was ESG before ESG was a thing, you know, trying to do some social good and not make everything about EBITDA and return on shareholder value.
100%. He was always looking to help. And now that's what he does full time. He's been working with pet charities for a number of years, rescuing animals, spaying and neutering pets. And that's turned into a lot of focus him and his organization have in the areas affected by the war in Ukraine, going in and feeding and rescuing and nursing animals back to health that are sort of that forgotten victim of war.
And so is it another fellow person you knew from UW that pulls you into your next gig?
Yeah. So my next gig ended up being sort of a return gig at the end of my time with working with Dan and professional services space. I think one of my breaking points was I was at Costco on a weekend just trying to get some shopping done. And I ran into the CFO from one of our customers, and he wanted to talk about his ERP implementation over a table full of, you know, Docker's khakis. And I just couldn't do that anymore. I was talking to a good buddy of mine, Eric Emmons. He was now the chief accounting officer at InfoSpace, and he really needed some help on the data side. He made that move that we all wish we could do sometimes, where he emailed the CEO all the things that are wrong with data. And so the CEO said, great, you own it now. And so he called me and said, hey, I own this thing now. Can you do it? I was more than happy to come back and give that a shot. Again, going back to that team dynamic and that trust dynamic, Eric and our whole crew are just those people that you can trust to do their part. And Eric gave me a lot of space and breathing room to be able to try things, whether that was with technology or process or people. He let me run my show, and it was a lot of trust to give me. It's my first director role, my first time trying a lot of different things. Eric created that safe space for us.
So you're back to the stability of a bigger company. You're not the guy signing the payroll checks. It's a little bit simpler. What did you realize about like the tools you were building and kind of the reinventions that happened at the company?
Well, at the time, I was in charge of a lot of different random technology things. It was sort of that thing in your family when if you're the webmaster, you obviously know how to repair somebody's watch as well. You know, somehow all the technology gets lumped under you. And so over that time there, it was more than just data and analytics. It was taking on data warehouse engineering and then corporate application and business technology engineering. It was taking on workplace technology and IT, networking, all that fun stuff, which then led to this whole period of M&A that the company was going through. We had a bunch of accounting reasons for why we wanted to acquire highly profitable, cash flow positive businesses. And myself and my friend and colleague Wason would be sent on the road on all of these M&A deals to do technology diligence and integrations after we had purchased the companies, which was always a trip to land at a new site. And we get introduced as Jason and Wason. Everybody thinks we're kidding, but nope, that's actually us. We got exposed to a ton of stuff, you know, these small businesses that had never had to close their books formally, right, until they were going through a sales process. Companies where technology was an afterthought and there's a lot of duct tape and baling wire everywhere. And our job was to go in and repair a lot of that, bring it up to public company standards. It was basically like doing IPOs again and again and again.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
You told me a story about a tennis ball company in San Francisco on the pre-call.
They sold not just tennis balls, tennis ball machines. So if you need to work on your backhand and don't have any friends, you can buy a tennis ball machine to do so. They sold trampolines, basically all this odd-sized freight. And they were based in San Francisco in Little Italy, top floor of maybe like a 4 or 5 story building. And one night somebody broke into the office to steal a bunch of equipment and floor samples. They didn't go in through the ground floor. They literally went ninja style off the side of the roof, down through the windows to bypass the locked doors and alarm systems. You couldn't make this up in a movie. If you tried, it would seem too ridiculous.
So they haul all these samples out of there. When I've seen people try to make like their own conglomerate, and maybe there'll be these synergies between these businesses that we own, like it often doesn't work out. Was that kind of the case here?
It was. And the company went through a lot of trial and error. I mean, we owned a tax preparation business, a network of podcasts and websites, search engines. We owned a company that made things like small household electronics, charging cables, HDMI cables. Actually, the headphones I'm wearing right now came from them. And you're absolutely right. We were looking for the synergies where one business plays off the other. I think what people discount is the level of coordination required to truly create synergy doesn't happen accidentally. You have to be very, very intentional about it. And you have to be very aware of the legal and financial implications of related party transactions and making sure that all of your valuations are above board and you're not giving preferential treatment. I mean, some very, very large companies, much larger than us, have gotten into trouble for running their own ads for their own services on their own websites and not doing the proper accounting for it. So definitely undervalued the headwinds, but the company has since divested of a lot of those ancillary businesses and went through a few more rebrands and has really been pretty successful in the tax and finance space. And I wish my former colleagues a lot of good fortune as they continue.
The team relocated to Dallas and you were like, nah, I really like Washington. So what's next for you?
Well, what was next for me was I got a chance to take a little bit of time off after they moved. And at the time, my kids were pretty young still and got the opportunity to spend a ton of time with them and with my wife, who is probably the best thing to come out of my time at InfoSpace because we met there. One of the unintended perks of that job. But the four of us got to spend just insane amounts of quality time together. And for me, marrying her and having children was such a pivotal part in my life in terms of building empathy and patience and an appreciation of more than just work. And so in that time period, I was ready to get back to work right away. I thought, I'm not going to take any time off. But I was at SeaTac Airport picking up a friend, and I ran into one of those co-founders I had worked with before, a guy by the name of John Keister, JK. He co-founded GoToNet and Marchex. And I just ran into him at the airport and we were catching up. I let him know what was going on and said, you know, would love to talk to you, kind of think about what I'm doing next. And he gave me some profound advice. And he said, no matter what you do, take some time to go sit on a rock, meditate, whatever your version of that is, go sit on a rock. And I took that literally and figuratively to heart. And it helped me see that there is a lot more to this life. Climbing the corporate ladder and the rat race and all of that can give you some level of fulfillment, but I needed to find better balance and I needed to make sure that the time I was spending away from my family at work was for something more important, a little bit more purpose-driven.
So I imagine you're much more picky about choosing your next role when you do decide to go back.
Yeah, I think picky is a good thing. Sometimes we say it as it's maybe more of a negative, but I think picky is good. I was able to start focusing on how can I work for a company that has a product that I believe in, where I'm going to be proud to tell my friends and family that I work there, that I can vouch for the product to other people, but also work for a company that is doing more than just profit loss and EBITDA. Find a company that has social good as well. And I happened to find that with Tableau Software up in Seattle, Washington, through the Tableau Foundation and their work supporting malaria research and infectious diseases in sub-Saharan Africa, with their focus on giving back to the local communities in which we do business. So supporting nonprofits and education with free Tableau licensing and professional services was my first opportunity to work at a much larger enterprise SaaS business that had actual teams and people dedicated to doing good, and where they expected you to volunteer your time, where they expected you to give back. That was just a whole new ballgame for me and really opened my eyes to how you can have a balance while you're at work.
Is this before they were part of Salesforce?
It was. This was the last 3 years before the acquisition. I was thankful to see that growth. You know, it was probably 3,000 to 5,000 employees in my time there. Got to see the explosion of things like Tableau Online. My team was really fortunate to be sort of in the center of the data universe, where we were running data and analytics and data warehousing at Tableau, right? Which is one of the top right companies in your Gartner Magic Quadrant. And we got to trial the software before all of our customers did and really dog food it so much that we named our internal data warehouse and Tableau server Alpo to really double down on the metaphor. Yeah. And so the lead up to the acquisition was one of extreme growth in our online business. That was something that when I joined the company, Tableau Online was just a small percentage of the company's sales, and we didn't have any internal use cases for it. And so some really intelligent folks on my team and our partners in product engineering collaborated to bring about half of our internal workloads to Tableau Online. And so it was fun to be a part of that evolution of a company trying something new. Even though they had been around for, you know, over a decade, there was always an idea of what can we do that's new and growth oriented. And so we got to be behind the scenes on that evolution.
Now, prior to my tech career, I would say my favorite job was working at Domino's, making and delivering pizza. And you somehow find a way to combine both a tech career and making and delivery of pizza. What's next?
When the acquisition was announced, there was a moratorium of sorts put on while some antitrust stuff got worked out. It left this sort of dead air of couldn't really start anything new. You were just kind of keeping the lights on. And we had a locally headquartered company called Mod Pizza up here in the Seattle area. They're 500 plus stores across the United States and British Columbia. And they were looking to go public and they needed to get their data house in order. It's, again, one of those situations of like, hey, this is a company whose product my family and I already vouch for by, you know, using our wallet there a couple times a month. Here's a company that really was more than just a pizza company. It's an engine for good is the way it's described. Scott and Ali Svensson started the company as a way to give back to communities and as a way to create second chances for people that need a leg up, whether that's formerly incarcerated and justice involved individuals, that's marginalized groups like LGBTQ homeless or underhomed folks. Really, they open their doors to everybody and anybody, and you bring your whole self. And that was a pretty cool opportunity to go and try to ride that pre-IPO wave that I hadn't yet done in my career, but to do so in a space that I think is a little bit, pardon the pun, underserved when it comes to technology. Retail restaurant, it's tough to make a buck, right? The margins are really thin. And so the technology is usually last year's model of everything. And so here's a company that was looking to modernize. And I thought I could bring some of that tech industry flavor to that business. One of the jokes that I have to, people say a lot at the corporate headquarters is, we're not just about making dough. But that's really true at Mod, is that it's about doing good while doing good, that you don't have to sacrifice your values and your purpose in order to make an extra buck. You can have both sides. You can grow a really profitable business and grow important, meaningful careers for people while at the same time giving back in terms of donation or services or what have you.
But you're there, most notably Friday, March 13th, 2020, when COVID hits. How does that disrupt everything?
Hindsight, not the best time to join a restaurant business, but hindsight, probably the best thing that could have happened to me, because I was able to be in a position where I thankfully did have a wealth of technology background that I could bring to the table to help us become really a digital business overnight. We were somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of our stores pre-COVID even had a delivery option. We were a in-store experience, and the restaurants were built to curate that experience. There were huge impacts from COVID around the world that I do not want to underplay or diminish. But, you know, when you have a crisis of that scale, sometimes the only way to rationalize it is to look inside your own box and say, how can I do something right here, right in front of me? And so for us, that was, how can we keep as many stores open as possible? Because if we close a store, that means that that is 20 people that now have to go look for a job. That means that that's one less delivery for the farmer that's producing the produce for our store. That's one less tenant paying rent in that building. And, you know, just the ripple effects of closing a store.
One less place to get takeout when everyone is leaning so heavily into takeout.
Exactly. And so we turned on delivery and curbside pickup options at 100% of our stores, I think in a 3-week period when it was originally intended to take 18 months to slowly, methodically roll out delivery. And it truly was a whole team effort of the digital marketing team and our operations team and our data team and the greater IT organization. All of these teams had to come together to mobilize this. And what happened is we become a digital company. We become a data company. We didn't have a lot of telemetry on our in-store ordering. Now all of a sudden people are ordering through an app or through the website. We're getting detailed ingredient level data that we never had before. We're getting address type data about delivery zip codes and things like that that we never had before. And so all of a sudden we have this treasure trove of data to take advantage of, and we needed a way to do it. And so our small but mighty team in a very short time period was able to stand up a net new data warehouse that included all of this new telemetry data, all these new operational insights, and slowly every single day. And when I say every day, I literally mean 7 days a week. We were slowly rolling out incremental improvements and incremental insights to the ways in which people are ordering the pizzas, to the toppings that they're using, and ingredient breakdowns. We were offering new insights into customer satisfaction. And we were opening up insights beyond just profit and loss and inventory turns and sales figures. We also used data to help protect our staff. We started up contact tracing reporting out of our warehouse that enabled our intake team so that when somebody called to say that they had tested positive, with one click, our business partners could look across every single overlap that that person had with other employees so that they could be contacted and told to remain home. It made a process that was taking about 2.5 to 3 hours per person that was testing positive. It got it down to one click. And to be able to take data and keep people safe with it was an experience that I had never had before. So when you look at the silver linings that this crisis had, it was the opportunity to do new things with data that we had never done before.
Now, about a year and a half ago, you moved on from there to Okta. Can you tell folks first, if they're not familiar with Okta, what do they do and what do you do there?
Sure. Okta is in the identity space. So it's all about workforce identity and customer identity. And we have a vision at Okta where we want to accelerate a world where everyone can safely use any technology. So our workforce product allows people to use things like single sign-on at their place of work, where they just type one username and password, and we broker all the sign-on to all their business applications like email or ERP, et cetera. And then we also have our Auth0 customer identity product, where with a few lines of code, we manage all of your customer identity on your website. So the username, the password, the multiple factors of authentication, like using SMS or social login, things like that, are all managed by us, and it's click to configure within the application. So the chance to join Okta was really, for me, another opportunity to say, okay, is this a product that I know and believe in? Yes. Used it at multiple companies, brought it into a company. Are they doing good in the world? Absolutely. Not just through Okta for Good, which is our social arm, which takes the 1% pledge and applies it to how we think about donating software, services, employee time, et cetera. But it also is an opportunity to work in an industry that is looking out for the little guy. I'm somebody that was bullied a lot as a child. The computer nerd stereotype, I think, applied to me. And as a result of that experience, in my adult life, I cannot stand bullies. I cannot stand people that are trying to take advantage of somebody else or somehow keep somebody else down. And when we look at the world of cyber threats out there, there's a huge digital divide in terms of online safety. And I mean, my own family, I've had family members be the subject of elder fraud through SMS and email campaigns to no small amount of money. And the fact that our company is out there trying to find ways to protect everybody, it's not just protect the largest organizations. It's not just protect those who have the most resources. It's everybody on every device. For me, it's a very fulfilling industry to be in, and to be able to apply my passion for data to better insights and things like ML-driven bot detection and bad actor detection is something that is really exciting and fulfilling overlap for me.
It sounds like a good mission that is in demand and profitable as well.
Exactly. You can do good while doing good.
So when you're not on the keyboard or defending grandma from the inbound phishing attempts, what are you doing for fun, for hobbies?
For fun, I would like to say that my Lego passion is totally because of my children who are 9 and 11. They're just a convenient scapegoat for what I do. I love building with them. We'll do our own Lego Masters challenges sometimes where we'll come up with a topic and then we all have to build something and show it off to each other. Or we'll build sets together or individually. I recently had the very zen experience of building the Lego Jazz Club while listening to my dad's favorite jazz artist, John Coltrane. And there's just something so peaceful about taking the pieces and just slowly putting them in one by one and lining them up. And you can really get lost in the meditative aspect of it. So that's what I do to calm down when I'm out and want to spend some time being a little more energetic. I also coach U11 girls soccer. There is nothing to give you empathy and patience more than running around the soccer pitch with a bunch of energetic fourth graders.
Any causes or charities that you're passionate about?
Well, I mentioned the thing about being bullied as a kid, right? And that is just something that I have zero tolerance for. And so I'm passionate about any cause that is giving a voice to people that are being held down or otherwise marginalized somewhere. One that's important to me is LGBTQIA+ youth who don't even have a safe space at home to go to. Like, home should be the safest place in the world. Like, it's a scary world out there. You should be able to come back and lay your head down and not have insecurity about how you're going to be treated by your own family. So we happen to have a number of great organizations in the state of Washington and nationally giving those safe spaces and helping folks to have that place they can go after school and be themselves and not have to hide behind multiple masks and repress who they are.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with the listeners of Underserved your experiences.
It's been a true pleasure, Andrew. I love what you're doing with this podcast and how you're giving voice to a whole range of folks in the industry. I've enjoyed listening to other people's stories, and I hope that I've created at least one anecdote that your listeners can take away.
I definitely think there are many. And to be honest, I've gotten probably as much out of being a host and meeting all those interesting people as anyone has being a guest. So thank you for joining us. And we'll talk to everyone else soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.